Hello there. You are listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge. Craig Blumenschein is off today. We're so happy to have you along. And of course, what's been on the mind of many North Dakotans, the story of what happened at a federal courthouse in Fargo last Wednesday. That's where and when former state senator Ray Holmberg was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. The following conversation, hosted by our director of radio, Ann Alquist, will analyze the hearing with a couple of legal experts, but I do want to mention that the topic is explicit and potentially triggering in nature, so it might not be appropriate for all listeners. Here are Ann's guests introducing themselves.
My name is Dane DeCray. I am a partner at the law firm Ringstrom DeCray, and I've been a lawyer for 10 years.
My name is Bruce Ringstrom, Jr. I'm the founding partner of Ringstrom DeCray. Grew up in Moorhead, and I have been a lawyer for about 16 years.
I know both of you had your eye on the sentencing hearing for former state senator Ray Holmberg. You're both defense attorneys. This was pretty tough stuff for his defense attorney, Mark Fries. Mr. Holmberg's defense attorney, Mark Fries, came out very strong, I would say. I mean, and as one would expect, he's got a client. I went out with a public defender once and I asked him what he did for a living, and he said, "I defend the Constitution." So it feels like a very sacred job in that respect. He took a long time with his sentencing recommendation, actually longer speaking than his opponent, the U.S. Attorney, Jennifer Poole. It was over an hour. Is that unusual?
Well, there are sentencing arguments that can go a very long time. I think Dane is in a better position to speak to this particular sentencing because of his expertise in federal court. I have had sentencing hearings in state court where the stakes, in fact, were higher than for Senator Holmberg, that went an hour, hour and a half, just my part. But most of the time, when the issues are clear and we understand the proclivities of the judge, the sentencing hearings will often be shorter. I was not particularly surprised at the length. I think Dane's opinion matters more here.
In federal court, that's an objectively long recommendation by defense counsel. But I think that we need to view everything related to Mr. Holmberg's case in a one-off prism. I think for the defense lawyer, for Mr. Fries, for the, I guess it's the acting U.S. attorney right now, Jennifer Poole, and even Judge Hovland, who's been on the bench for many years, this has got to be among the three biggest cases that they've probably ever had in their career. And so I think when you also know that the eyes of the state are upon you, I think you take it upon yourself to make sure that you don't leave any stone unturned. But I would say that, at least in my experience, sometimes what you're really looking for is the Goldilocks sentencing argument, which is, you know, not too hot, not too cold, just right. And I wasn't there in the courtroom, but in my experience, sometimes if you go a little bit too long, especially in federal court, because going into the hearing, both sides have already given forth their written arguments to the judge. And so if you give a long written argument, and then you go into court and you give the same long oral argument, the question sort of becomes, you know, did you not think the judge has read it before or was listening? And so I wasn't there, but this is probably rare in terms of the length of a normal federal sentencing hearing.
There are optics involved too, as Dane pointed out. The judge has read everything. Lots of sentencing in federal court and in state court are reviewing issues that judges see over and over again in cases. There's a set of cases, you know, in federal court, you have drug conspiracies, you have child sex abuse material cases and the like. Everybody knows what the ranges are, and it requires a particularly odd set of facts for a judge to go beyond what is predicted. Here, this was a rare case. This was something that Judge Hovland probably hadn't seen ever in his career, or certainly nothing close to it. So that's a justification for a much longer comprehensive sentencing argument.
The hearing itself was almost 7 hours. So, I mean, it sounds like that was unusual as well.
Yeah, that is among the longest that I've heard of in this district. And I do also want to credit Judge Hovland. My guess is Judge Hovland knew going in relatively where he was going to land. And if he knew going in that he was going to land above what's called the sentencing guidelines, he knows that there's a good chance that his decision will be appealed. And the best thing a judge can do when they think an appeal may happen is to make a very comprehensive record. And the most comprehensive record is a 7-hour hearing where everything's on the record. So if you just refer to this nebulous sentencing argument or the earlier written papers, that makes it hard for the Court of Appeals to know exactly what you're talking about. And so I use this term a lot, and I'm going to get a smirk from Bruce, but this was a belt and suspenders moment. This was a, I'm going to make sure that I do everything in my power to let the Court of Appeals know what I did and why. So likely or inevitably, when Mr. Holmberg appeals, they will not wonder why I did something, because you'll sometimes read Court of Appeals opinions where they'll say, we really wish the district court would explain themselves more. And because we can't read their minds, we're going to have to decide A or decide B. Whereas here, I don't think anybody's going to say we didn't know what everybody was thinking and saying at that hearing.
And I will say it felt like a trial. It felt like a trial in there. I thought I was, an extra from Law and Order or something because of the length of it, but also the pugilism that's involved in a courtroom between prosecution and defense attorneys that happens. And I sort of assumed it was because to get things on public record, because there wasn't a trial, because evidence wasn't submitted in a public court record or exhibits or documents, this was an opportunity for the prosecution, for the U.S. Attorney's Office to put it in public court record.
Absolutely. It's in federal court, sentencings often look more like trials. There is a strategic posture that federal criminal defense attorneys will take, which is treat the sentencing like a trial. Do everything you would as though it were a trial. Contest every fact that you can. Build out a narrative that is most likely to move the court, move the judge to give you the best possible sentence.
So this was a sentencing hearing, felt like a trial. Mr. Holmberg was indicted in August of 2024. He signed the plea agreement in September that convicted him of one count of intent to traveling to engage in illicit sex acts. Jennifer Poole, the acting U.S. attorney, relied heavily on evidence from Special Agent Cassetta's testimony that basically revealed just very detailed accounts of Mr. Holmberg's sexual life. It certainly did prove the intent to travel. He traveled 14 times between 2011 and 2021. There was a number, 9,000 pages I have in my notes of PDFs of cyber chats, 35,000 pages of investigative documents, exhibits, the 9 exhibits of pictures and emails. But very little evidence of that pertained to the intent to travel for sex with minors, with underage sex workers, which is where Mr. Fries came in very explicitly to point that out. And yet the result of 10 years exceeding the sentencing recommendation by acting U.S. Attorney Jennifer Poole, you're a federal defense attorney. How important is it for the emotional factor? She brought forth impact testimony. I mean, look, it was poignant. I mean, you couldn't help. I mean, especially when Special Agent Cassetta, this is what happened in the courtroom, as probably one of Mr. Holmberg's first alleged victims spoke when he was a high school student in Grand Forks in the 1990s and broke down, and the special agent brought him a box of tissues. I mean, I was tearing up. How do you address that as a defense attorney? And I can talk about what Mark Fries did. I mean, he was very noble about it. He commended the alleged victims for being courageous. But, when you're in a process like that where the prosecution, frankly, was weak, how do you address that as a defense attorney?
One of the interesting things about the approach in this case is something you brought up, which is there was a victim problem, as we call it, in defense land. And that is the fact that what you're getting at is There's evidence that Mr. Holmberg traveled. There's evidence that he at least spoke about doing the conduct alleged. But there's nobody, victim, on the stand up there saying, I'm the person in Prague that Mr. Holmberg had sex with. And instead, what it was other people who were talking about conduct that they engaged with Mr. Holmberg that he wasn't charged for here.
Nor convicted.
And I don't even know if these individuals were underage at the time. And that is a very interesting strategy that is allowed in federal court, which is to be able to use other bad acts at sentencing to try to help bolster the underlying act that you're convicted of. And from what I heard about the sentencing, I think that's what Mr. Freeze talked about. And I have to say, as a defense lawyer, I find some sympathy in that complaint.
And I think he did that for a reason, because he was advocating in the sentencing recommendation for home confinement.
I think if he had any inclination that the judge was going to depart as far up as he would have, he probably would have done a joint recommendation with the government for the 37 months. I mean, it's very easy in hindsight to try to say what you should do when you see what the judge did. But I think I would have taken a similar approach, and Bruce and I would have worked together on this case. We worked together on every case. But we would have made clear that we can both be sympathetic to these men's horrific stories with Mr. Holmberg, but also point out that that is not what we are talking about here today. And it's very easy to be distracted by other conduct that, in our opinion, we would argue is not relevant to these charges.
The most important piece of proof that Jennifer Poole had at her disposal was Senator Holmberg's guilty plea. Think about it from that perspective. Like, that's the linchpin piece of evidence. And it does feel, set aside my personal feelings about whether this human being should be incarcerated for his behavior, bringing in evidence that doesn't bear directly on the crime that's been charged and the crime that's been pleaded guilty to is basically character evidence. And character evidence says, well, if you did it before, you'll do it again, or propensity evidence really is the better way to describe it. In Minnesota court, and actually to a large extent in North Dakota court, you can't bring in propensity evidence absent very – well, you can't ever bring it in, but you can bring in evidence similar to that with very specific reasons to do so. And here – essentially, it was used to prejudice the judge into saying, I can't turn a blind eye to these things. And from my perspective, I think that's unfortunate.
I just have one. I do want to follow up on that, because I've got a list of quotes from defense attorney Mark Freeze that I wrote down. These things aren't recorded. They're, of course, it's going to be a public court record, but I wanted to make sure I took copious notes. In his sentencing recommendation, one of the things that he did say, the arguments are meant to inflame. That's a direct quote. So it was obvious as he was delivering his sentencing recommendation that he wanted to address. You talked about optics. Mm-hmm. You know, there was definitely a bit of kabuki theater going on here. There was definitely a sense from defense attorney Mark Freeze to come back and make sure that he painted a picture of how much of this case was coming out of the court of public opinion.
I definitely think that there is a large component there. But our job when we're here today is sort of to look in both sides of this case. You know, the devil's advocate perspective there is, if the defense counsel felt that strongly about the weaknesses of the case, they could have taken the case to trial.
Why not take this to trial?
Well, and at trial, just when Bruce is talking about, it's much harder to get character evidence in at trial than it is at sentencing. And so had this case gone to trial, Jennifer Poole still could have tried to get these other victims in to testify. But the standard is higher and harder, because at that point, you're presumed innocent. And therefore, the standard to allow character evidence in is more difficult.
And the burden of proof would have been on Jennifer Poole.
Correct. And once you're at sentencing, the standard to allow character evidence in is much lower. And so there was a calculated decision behind closed doors that we will never know about between Ray Holmberg and his defense team to say, do we think that they have a good enough case, or what is the reason why we are not putting them to their evidence and possibly eliminating these two victims that you heard from? Because at a trial, I would argue, in my opinion, they probably wouldn't have been allowed to testify. Now, I'm not a judge. I didn't get confirmed by the Senate. But it's much easier to get evidence in at sentencing than it is at trial. And so going out of this, hearing Mr. Freeze's arguments, hearing everyone's opinion, it's a universal opinion I've heard from people talking about how these victims, they didn't understand the relevance related to the actual charge. And so I'm curious as to the decision-making process, and I'm not second-guessing it. It's very easy to play Monday morning quarterback. I am not doing that. But this would have been a very different experience had this been at a trial versus sentencing.
One thing to remember about what a trial would look like, again, as Dane noted, we don't have access to discovery and we've never spoken to Senator Holmberg, but the federal government, when they prosecute a case, are very good at using overwhelming volumes of circumstantial evidence to build a narrative such that a jury says, well, no, there's no direct evidence, but there's so much circumstantial evidence, I feel like all the doubts were ruled out. Now, there are attacks that can be made, but you talked about how long the sentencing hearing was. Imagine 3 or 4 weeks of evidence from the government. Imagine that. And so the attack from defense counsel to chip away at that, I mean, it can be done. We've won, you know, big cases with lots of circumstantial evidence, but the risk is huge, and that had to have been something they were thinking about.
And they likely, but not certainly, would have needed Mr. Holmberg to testify. If you heard in the sentencing, even Judge Hovland was very direct about, why would you write this stuff? Why would you say this? And there was a lot of walking back, like, it was puffery, or it was locker room talk, or I was just bragging to my friends. And it seemed like Judge Hovland didn't buy it. And Judge Hovland was essentially the jury in this situation. And so there is just a lot of risks, even though there's not that direct evidence victim. You know, Mr. Holmberg, those 8,000 texts you mentioned and that five-person group chat, I mean, it would be very hard, I think, day after day, having those be read into the record, providing all of the context, to then try to say with a straight face that this was all merely puffery, or this was all just boys being boys. It could be done. It is done. But it's always easy for people to second guess decisions made in these types of cases. And we are doing our best knowing the tip of the iceberg. What we saw at the hearing and what we know about is that little part that pokes out of the water. Underneath is a whole vast piece of ice that very good lawyers, and I think even at the hearing, Mr. Freeze was complimented by the judge. He's a very good attorney.
They both were. The quote that I have from Judge Hovland was, and he said this directly to Mr. Holmberg, this has been excellent lawyering, and that he got the best defense that he could possibly wanted. And then the other quote that I have from the judge as well that he directly said to Mr. Holmberg was, you didn't have the best hand of cards. It was tough stuff. As Mark Freeze spoke during his sentencing recommendation, I'm a student of history, legal history, he did have a bit of a Clarence Darrow moment, who, of course, was famous for defending the biology teacher in the Scopes Monkey trial. But specifically, he defended Leopold and Loeb, the two young men who stalked and murdered a 14-year-old Bobby Frank, stuffed his body into a pipe. Terrible, brutal crime that just shocked the nation. Guilty. 100%. But then went in front of the judge, pleading with him for 12 hours that they not be hanged. And there was a little bit of that. He wasn't pleading necessarily, but he did speak directly to the media. He said, it's hard to blame the media. They had no idea five men were being investigated and received immunity and cooperation agreements. I'm presuming he said that because he wanted it on the record.
Sure.
And again, to the optics point. But the other piece that he talked about, and this was a political element to it, where he spoke to the tone nationally, events going on in Washington, D.C. He talked about how the Department of Justice is being weaponized. He talked about a mob mentality that pervades our environment that is scary to him. These are direct quotes from the courtroom. Does that surprise you that he made those larger contextual comments about the time that we're in? Is that something you would do? Again, I realize it is a very unusual, almost a once-in-a-lifetime case.
It doesn't surprise me, but there's a little bit of a logical gap there because the indictment was brought under a different Justice Department, right? It is carried through. So
You're talking about the Department of Homeland Security?
No, I'm talking about how there was a different presidential administration. There was a different attorney general when this indictment came down than the attorney general now. And so the argument that this case could be considered a product of the weaponization of the Justice Department doesn't make sense in the way that you might argue that about other things. You could make the case, this isn't about the Justice Department, but that the Biden pardons were impermissible or the Trump pardons were impermissible or what the Justice Department or the Biden administration did was unjust, the Trump, you know, so on. But here, this one ranged across two of them. So I sort of understand what he's saying. I do wonder whether, I mean, it obviously had it didn't have the right effect on the judge. Remember in the Leopold and Loeb case that Clarence Darrow successfully got life on, the default was death and he got life. Here, my understanding was it probably could have landed on 36 months, and the judge gave him three times the amount. So ultimately, the arguments were unavailing. They not only did they not work, the end result was something like triple what it could have been.
Well, but the end result could be that he dies in prison. And if it were 36 months, it could be that he would not die in prison because he would only have to. I mean, I think I'm just.
That's my point. That's my point. That the argument didn't achieve what the defense would have hoped.
And then that was the age argument and the his heart issues, his medical issues just didn't play.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about the media component of this? I did have a moment watching one of the local commercial TV news here where they talked about the crimes of Ray Holmberg. And I did have a moment. I was like, what crimes? It was one count. I got into very sort of specific anal retentive accuracy mode. And I'm curious, as you watch your cases get played out in the media, what do you wish the media would pay attention to? What do they get wrong? And where are they getting things right?
Well, I think Dana and I can both opine on that in different ways. Whenever you work in a field, in a specialty, you often find yourself bristling at the way the media report it, whatever it may be. There are other fields and avocations that I know a great deal about, and when I see the media report them, I think those are the wrong words. They don't know what they're talking about. And it certainly is true with criminal work. You know, I will read an article about one of my clients. Trial begins next Tuesday. It's not trial. It's a pretrial or it's an omnibus or it's a dispositional conference. And so it sort of frames it as though a jury is going to come on that day. Yes, when members of the media say Senator Ray Holmberg's crimes, they are assuming that he is guilty. And that's really problematic. You know, Dana and I have a deep concern for due process, and part of due process is helping people understand, helping the media understand how the process actually works.
And I think the question that when it bothers judges with sloppy lawyers and lawyers with sloppy journalists is, number one, how frequent does it happen? And number two, maybe more with the media, is there something more at play than just we were in a rush to try to get the story out? I think news is becoming a bit shaded in whatever direction that the company or the organization is pushing. And that goes on both sides of the political spectrum. And I think if I had to guess, I'm sure Mr. Freeze was talking about that more than the media getting, you know, a small detail wrong. I sympathize with the issue related to the secrecy of the other individuals, because without knowing that, it does really make it seem like it was Mr. Holmberg and Mr. Holmberg alone, and it was all of these things that it was much more complicated than that. And I don't know if that was because it was under seal or there was not an ability to talk about that, because I've talked about this case as it's gone on because of my time in federal court. And I was left opining, thinking there must be more to this. There must be more to this story that we're not being told, because the trajectory was just being, it was going in a different path than I'd ever seen. And the problem with people, humans in general, is when you're left in the dark, you draw your own conclusions or you go to these bad places where it might not be a nefarious reason, but when you don't know, you begin to assume the worst. And I think that happened a couple times in this case where people jumped to that conclusion. And I think that's what Mr. Freeze was talking about in his argument.
I agree completely. It's hard when the government is allowed to give consideration to other witnesses. And then depending on the situation, defense counsel can't even really bring that out in a way that helps the fact finder, the judge, the jury, whatever, to understand that really influences what's going on here. So from a simplistic perspective, someone might say, well, it really doesn't matter whether they were cooperators or not. If he did it, he did it, and he deserves this. The problem is if the process is so lopsided, then even an innocent person can be forced to plead guilty. And I have seen that happen because the weight of the government can be so oppressive, somebody who's factually innocent or innocent of the most serious charges will plead because they know even with the best defense counsel, they're not going to win a trial.
You are listening to Ann Alquist's conversation with defense attorneys Dane DeCray and Bruce Ringstrom. They're talking about the sentencing hearing of Ray Holmberg last Wednesday. He got 10 years in federal prison. So what about an appeal? They'll get into the weeds of that coming up next. And they'll also talk about sort of the unusual way that Judge Hovland speaks to clients. You are listening to Main Street on this Monday. I'm Eric Dethridge in for Craig Blumenschein, who is off today. If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation about the sentencing hearing in Fargo last Wednesday of former State Senator Ray Holmberg. Our Director of Radio, Ann Alquist, is speaking with defense attorneys Dane DeCray and Bruce Ringstrom. More of our conversation now, but I should say, as we did at the outset, the topic is explicit and potentially triggering in nature, so it might not be appropriate for all listeners.
And I think that this is probably a rare example, actually, of where politics and criminal justice intersect, which is probably why it's so fascinating to us as well, because he was such a powerful man and a charming man. You know, he was well-liked, is still well-liked by many of his constituents. And I'm curious to hear, was justice served on Wednesday?
A number of years ago, I represented someone who was charged with what used to be called child pornography. We now call it child sex abuse material, CSAM. My client had never touched a child. He had never taken a photograph of a child. He had used his computer to download a very large number of images and videos of child sex abuse material. He didn't have so much as a speeding ticket on his record. And after a year and a half of litigation, my client was sentenced to 13 years in prison. Now, I abhor the very existence of child sex abuse material, and I condemn as a private citizen the possession, the transmission, and so on. But is it just that that person who never touched a child got 12 and a half years in federal prison, whereas someone who, based on what the guilty plea is, based on the evidence that was put forth, almost certainly did have sexual contact with underage children, get 10 years? That's a difficult question to answer.
And Bruce's example is exactly what Judge Hovland was talking about. He packaged it in a different way, but Judge Hovland has been on the bench for at least 20 years, I would guess more. He's a senior judge. He's the dean of the North Dakota federal bench. He's widely respected on both sides of the aisle. He's methodical. He's thoughtful. He speaks very slowly and deliberately. And I'm sure going into the case, he had his law clerks pull every case involving CSAM or having sex with underage individuals across North Dakota that he probably had in his whole career. And I can guarantee it, but I would stake quite a bit of my reputation on this case was markedly lower than any of those. And so that has to do with the federal sentencing guidelines, which I'm sure Jennifer Poole brought up. But I think he thought, justice is not done if I stand here and give this individual, Ray Holmberg, a three-year sentence, even if the guidelines tell me to, when there every criminal lawyer who practices in federal court has a client Bruce talked about, who we call it passive and active. Both are wrong, both are horrible, but passive means there are not identifiable victims in the sense of new individuals. All of CSAM, every person is victimized each time you view it. But I think he had trouble saying that I can't be the one that say justice is done and give this man a 3-year sentence when normally people are lucky to get anything close to 10 years. And on top of it, and that this is probably an unfortunate coincidence, it certainly can't be a powerful state senator, which then allows the media and other people to say there's two systems of justice, one for the Ray Holmbergs of the world and one for the Bruce's clients of the world. And so to Judge Hovland's credit, and it's his decision, I can't say I would act the same way. I mean, that's, again, why being a judge is a very terrifying prospect for me. But I think he said to himself, I'm going to put my thumb on the scale here, and I'm going to find the justice that I think bears in this case. And to him, it was 7 years more. So to many people, it seems like an enormous increase. But to those who practice, that's still a low sentence. You would tell your client at the beginning of a case, if they had this kind of a crime, if we get 120 months, because we talk about months in the federal court, we don't call it 10 years. If you get 120 months, we're going to be happy, which is a whole, you know, different discussion.
Do you anticipate an appeal? And I will say it was interesting to watch the judge address Mr. Holmberg directly and spend not an insignificant amount of time telling him about the appeal process. I mean, he didn't literally encourage him to appeal, but, sure, you know, it takes 5 minutes. Mr. Freeze can get it done really quickly. I mean, it was
belt and suspenders, because there will be an appeal. Mr. Holmberg has nothing to lose to do it. He has it by right because they went over the guidelines. And Judge Hovland is very well known to be the most active individual judge who speaks to clients at sentencing. That is a rarity. You saw it in people who don't go to court very often, maybe think that's normal. Usually judges just listen to what everybody has to say and then make their decision. Judge Hovland here was very interested in this case and was very interested in hearing from Mr. Holmberg before he sentenced him. And I think that, too, was an indication to me that this was going to be a different outcome than what was expected.
And I want to talk about the appeal a little bit, because a conscientious judge will do whatever they believe will protect their rulings so that they don't get overturned on appeal. And so asking those questions, getting that evidence to support the sentence that was pronounced, I think is probably part of what Judge Hovland did. I also think, quite frankly, the fact that he told Senator Holmberg, you had an excellent defense, you had excellent defense counsel, is his way of saying, don't you dare claim ineffective assistance of counsel because you had great lawyers.
Because there's two things that Mr. Holmberg can appeal. Under a plea agreement in federal court, normally you don't get to appeal if it stays within the guidelines. The only thing you get to appeal is that you claim that you had an ineffective lawyer. If the sentence is above the guidelines, you can appeal and say that that sentence is unfairly too long or too harsh. So there will be two avenues that Mr. Holmberg can appeal. One, I had really crappy lawyers, which Judge Hovland sort of fixed. And two is, you gave me way more time than you should have and way more time than the guidelines say you should. That's what the appeal will be about. But it's important to know, even if he wins, it doesn't start the case over. He's not guilty anymore. It's only a resentencing. So they've accepted their fate as to there's no way to go back and have a new trial. All that happens is he's resentenced, likely in front of a new judge, because the idea would be it would be hard for Judge Hovland to make a different decision. But this appeal will be on one thing and one thing only. Was this too harsh?
Gentlemen, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for helping us understand our justice process in this extraordinary sentencing hearing of former Senator Ray Holmberg.
That was our director of radio, Ann Ahlquist, speaking with defense attorneys Dane DeCray and Bruce Ringstrom about the sentencing of former state senator Ray Holmberg to 10 years in prison at a federal courthouse in Fargo last Wednesday. Coming up, Tom Bruce So will introduce you to an East Grand Forks, Minnesota teacher that might make you want to sing along to a classic folk song. But now, a story of immigrants from Tom Ezern and his Plains Folk Essay.
Trachoma, an infectious eye disease now handled readily with antibiotics, was considered a menace, the major cause of blindness early in the 20th century. It came to public attention in 1897 when Dr. Porter S. Wyman, Surgeon General of the U.S. Marines, issued a report calling trachoma a dangerous, contagious disease, after which inspectors at U.S. ports of entry commenced watch for it. Inspections of all immigrants, lifting of eyelids, looking for the telltale follicles underneath, were standard by 1905. Treatments were sketchy, commonly washes with various solutions, sometimes minor but painful surgery to scrape the inside of the eyelids. Although there was a lot of muddled thought attributing trachoma, sometimes called Egyptian ophthalmia, because Napoleon's armies were blamed for bringing it home from the Nile, or perhaps granular ophthalmia after the physical symptoms on the eyelids, whatever they called it, attributing the disease to lack of hygiene and poor living conditions. Medical people had a clear grasp it was a contagious disease, and public officials thought they could keep it out of the country. They were eager to do this because all this got wrapped up with the anti-immigrant nativism of the time, as the number of European immigrants reaching American shores got up to 1 million a year or more and included many more people from unaccustomed Eastern European origins, such as Germans from Russia, headed for the Great Plains, including, as recounted earlier, Magdalena Klipfel, who made her way to Ashley, North Dakota by way of Canada, through means I am now ready to explain. For there were other German Russians trying to get into the United States and being rebuffed on account of trachoma. In 1901, Senator H.C. Hansbrough got involved with a case brought to him by constituents at Richardton. A relative of theirs, Benedict Freed, had made his way from Russia to Baltimore only to be detained on account of infection. He was said to have $2,000 in hand and be ready to buy a farm in North Dakota. He had come with 3 children in tow. I don't know the resolution of his case. What Mr. Freed needed to do was get in touch with a fellow named Louis Feigler in Neche, North Dakota. Feigler was what we today would call a coyote, a human smuggler operating on the border. There were many like him, according to the American agent stationed in Winnipeg to handle immigration matters. That official allowed, "There was no doubt a great deal of it went on," and said, "In every case, the persons captured were severely dealt with." If they were caught, that is. Feigler got tripped up in 1903. It seems 3 families of Germans from Russia, having been rejected in Winnipeg for entry into the States, took a train south to the border town of Gretna, where they were taken in hand by Feigler. He took them by back roads across the border to Bathgate, whence they proceeded on to Grand Forks. The German Russians, numbering 19 persons, were taken into custody there and deported. Feigler was arrested and charged in Fargo. I find no disposition of his case. So there was no way Magdalena Klipfel, with her medical record, could have entered North Dakota legally from Manitoba. Officials in Portal were rejecting anyone suspected of infection. 19 in one day, it was reported. Magdalena was a resourceful young woman, and she found someone like Louis Feigler, only smarter, to fetch her into North Dakota and the arms of her family in McIntosh County.
You know, we all have that memorable teacher who really inspired us, whom we have carried with us into our adulthood as one of the most impactful people of our youth. Mine was Miss Anderson, Miss Heisler now. She still teaches. She taught poetry in 11th grade. And books like The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner by Alan Sillitoe. Really love that book. That book in particular influenced my songwriting style. Miss Heisler just made learning fun. Who was your memorable teacher? For many students at Sacred Heart in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, Mr. Lund will be their memorable teacher. Like Mrs. Heisler, Mr. Lund, too, makes learning fun. He even has a banjo and 2 guitars at the ready behind his desk to sing a folk song or in some way use those instruments to teach and tell the story of America. He's a musical English teacher, one of his students commented. I visited Mr. Lund, Pete, to talk about his love of teaching, his passion for music and English. He celebrates nearly 30 years in his career, and he is a true local hero. In case you don't know, I've been picking up some extra work, and I've become the high school English teacher here at Sacred Heart. It's been a lot of fun. Pete's right next door. So sometimes I'll hear a little banjo or a little guitar or some music kind of creeping through the walls. And I know that Pete's been a fan of music, and well, it's one thing that we have in common is folk music. Do you bring folk music into the classroom, into your English?
We do a unit in the eighth grade, folk tales. One in particular we do is the Sinking the Edmund Fitzgerald by Gordon Lightfoot. And we go through the history, what happened, because I was a young person when that ship sank. And I have a vague memory of that tragedy. And when that song came out, it was just such a mega hit.
At 7 p.m., a main hatchway gave in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know you. The captain wired in, he had water coming in, and the good ship and crew was in peril. And later that night, when his lights went out of sight, came the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
And just the sound of the guitars and everything, just mimicking the ocean going on and on and on. And for him to write that song and do it in a way that he wouldn't be criticized that he was taking advantage of the situation and was showing respect to the families, was an incredible endeavor.
Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? The searchers all say they'd have made Whitefish Bay if they'd put 15 more miles behind her.
Storytelling is still not out of vogue. I mean, if you can come up with a good story, and you can get their attention. And if you can entertain them, and that's what it's all about, you know, trying to keep their attention, entertain them, all the better. So I'm always telling them a story about something that's happened, and some of it's even true. You know, quite a bit of it's true, but there's a little fabrication. I do go a little beyond sometimes just to see what their reactions will be, and I fess up, though, eventually.
How long have you been teaching English here in East Grand Forks at Sacred Heart?
About 28 years, you know, not including, well, maybe including, I'm not sure, the couple of years that I subbed here.
What is it that you've learned all these years being a teacher?
Boy, you know, always be positive, come in ready each day to start over, be prepared, and if it weren't for the last minute, things would never get done. You know, these kids, they're precious, you know what, treat them like your own, love them like your own. They're not, and they're your students, and you are their mentor, but treat them in that way with respect. I think that's the best way to connect with them and to get material across to them to be a good teacher.
Our visit today with Mr. Pete Lund, English teacher and folkster just like myself here in East Grand Forks, Minnesota at Sacred Heart School. Thank you so much, Pete, for being on the Great American Folk Show.
Oh, you're welcome. It's an honor. It's been great. And I'm looking forward to the rest of the year here, listening to the interesting things going on just down the hall here from me. And hopefully that there's some interesting things happening on the other side of the wall here, too.
Well, Pete, speaking of walls and halls, you know, I heard a lovely song coming from your room the other day. And I'm wondering, I see you've got your guitar there. I've got my guitar right here. Let's just do it. I know you're going to know it. We'll do it in that famous key that everybody knows the song in.
Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff and brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Puff the Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Together they would travel on a boat with billowed sail. Jackie kept a lookout perched on Jack's gigantic tail. Noble kings and princes would bow whenever they came, and pirate ships would lower their flags when Puff roared out his name. Oh, Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Puff, and got him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff.
Come to life on Dakota Datebook 5 times a day, Monday through Friday, on Prairie Public. We tell North Dakota's story one colorful character at a time. Dakota Datebook, your daily dose of North Dakota history on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for March 31st. On this date, in 1909, an incredible story hit the press. The Wahpeton Times reported that Farmer Olson, who lived 3 miles north of Jamestown, had spotted a man hurriedly skipping across his fields. Olson had never seen anyone so far off the beaten path and so cheerful outside of hunting season. He quickly concluded it must be the patient who had escaped from the insane asylum in Jamestown a few days earlier. Olson hopped on his horse to chase the man and stopped at a neighbor's house to call the authorities. He informed them of his location and said he was about to capture the escapee. Olson then resumed the chase, roped the man, tied him up, and sat on him until the authorities arrived. When the asylum guard showed up, the suspect was overjoyed to be freed from his captor. He introduced himself as Aubrey Bloom, an actor traveling with the James Company. Bloom explained he was a fan of outdoor exercise and often took long walks in the country. He had thought Farmer Olson was the escaped madman and feared for his life. Of course, none of the story could be verified, which may explain why it was published on April 1st, April Fool's Day. The Jamestown Hospital was authorized by the Dakota Territory Legislative Assembly in 1883 and opened on May 15, 1885, 4 years before North Dakota became a state. Stories like this involving the insane asylum became common as the new system of mental health treatment was being adopted across the U.S. and have long outlived those institutions. Mental health jokes and coping humor continue to persist, reflecting the times we live in. For better or worse, laughter remains a reliable stress reliever. According to 2024 data from the Centers for Disease Control, nearly 1 in 4 U.S. adults, 58.7 million people, live with a mental health condition. Additionally, 1 in 7 children, ages 3 to 17, around 8 million kids, have a diagnosed mental or behavioral health condition. Mental Health Awareness Months focus on specific issues year-round, and April is Stress Awareness Month. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Lee Zerdrick. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
All right. right, that's Main Street for this Monday. I'm Eric Etheridge and for Craig Blumenschein, who will be back with you tomorrow when he asks, are you a good listener? Discover how poor listening is costing you big time. We'll speak with the author of What It's Costing You Not to Listen and how the power of understanding can transform your life. Very interesting conversation. To be sure, join Craig tomorrow at 3 and 7 p.m. Central right here on Prairie Public. In the meantime, have a wonderful rest of your Monday.